Can I just begin then by asking you to tell me how you got involved in pirate radio in Loud in your youth?
Good question, actually. It's that long ago. 35 years this December, I think it is. Basically, I wrote a letter into to Boyneside. I'm not sure, quite sure who I sent it into. It could have been Ebon or Eddie. And he says, oh, absolutely, feel free, come on over, and you can sit in on a few shows and stuff. At the time, I was working in Dunn Stores when I was 16 years of age. So, you know, after work in Dunn's, I'd probably tend to go over to Boyneside and sit in whoever was on air. That's basically how it started. I mean, I was always into radio. Back in the day when I was younger, like, I was mad into the old Radio Nova in Dublin. I was more concentrating on the, what songs and jingles were played rather than doing the homework. And even way before that, Radio Luxembourg would have been a big one. BBC Radio 1 on a Sunday evening with Janice Long. She did an all request type of show, which I remember very well. But Boyneside, yeah, I just went over and helped, you know, as you used to do like years ago, you know, make the tea, wash the dishes or whatever you had to do just to get the foot in the door. And I think shortly after that, I think in 1986, I think 85, 86, I got the opportunity to produce or panel Dermot Kieran's on a Sunday. And what Dermot used to do on a Sunday was a roundtable discussion, basically about the topics of the week or the day. Be something like similar to a lot of the talk shows that's on current radio in the mornings. Like, so he'd be in sort of the main room, I'd be in the studio, you know, getting people on the phones and, you know, making sure the microphones are working and stuff like that, and playing the commercials on time and bringing in the news. So that was probably the first big gig, not being on air, with Jeremy Kearns, which was very, good, experience for working the desk. And then, of course, you know, you're meeting sort of local politicians and sort of people that were in the news probably that particular week as well. So, yeah, that was the first real taste of Boyneside.
And you were still 16 or 17 when you were producing that current affairs program, were you?
I was, yeah. Basically, yeah, about 17 years of age, yeah. So every Sunday I'd go over, have a chat with Dermot Kearns and see what guests were in, make sure that they sat okay around the table. See if you want the tea or water or whatever it was, and then just bang, away we went with the show. Like, he sort of gave me hand signals and that was it.
And were you conscious of how, did you feel that you looked very young to these politicians? Did they look at you twice wondering who this kid was, or was that so common, do you think, in the station at the time that they didn't bat an eyelid?
I don't think so, because everyone really looked young back in the day then, like, you know what I mean? So it was fine. I mean, like, a lot of the presenters probably, I could have been the youngest there, maybe, but I'd say, you know, all the guys that were there were probably 3 or 4 years older than me, and that was about it.
Obviously, pirate radio back then was a pretty young place in general.
I think it was, yeah. I mean, like, you know, the likes of Derek Flood and Tommy Scott, you know, they worked there as well. So, I mean, like, you had people passing through also, like, that ended up in sort of Radio Nova in Dublin for a little stint. But yeah, Boyneside was the main one. I was happy enough to stay. I sort of got, you know, I had the Sunday, then I sent in with Michael Common, or David Brown used to do a slot on a Saturday or a Sunday. And I used to sit in with him, and I think he left. And, you know, he put a good word in for me with Ebon, and I ended up getting his slot. I think it was either one Saturday or Sunday, I'm not too sure. And that was the start of them. So after a while, then I ended up doing both Saturday and Sunday nights. So, yeah, it was quite hectic. I mean, like, working in Dunn's, like, some days in Dunn's, like, I'd finish about 7 o'clock in the evening, and this was going forward a bit when I was doing a nighttime show. I was on air at 7:30, so I'd leave Dunn's and West Street about 7:05, and I'd be on the air at 7:30. I'd be running across West Street and draw it into the house and sort of, you know, get the pile of records, and away we went.
And was this the Radio Romance days, Michael? When did that programme start?
Actually, listening back to some old tapes there over the last few days, nighttime music was fairly big. Eddie Caffrey did nighttime music, then Jim Agnew, and then I took over from Jim, I think. But listening back to some tapes in 1986, I do reference Radio Romance. So there was Radio Romance there to a certain extent before LMFM, because I was and still am known for Radio Romance through the 90s and the early noughties on that station. But yeah, I was surprised because I vaguely remembered it. I know Michael Common, when I was mentioned around the round table on the final couple of hours on the last day of Boyneside, so my name was mentioned, and then Michael Common and David Brown, same person, obviously, commented Radio Romance. So yeah, so ever since 1986, that tag has stuck.
And were you conscious that you were building up a listenership or a following over this time? What kind of interaction did you have with listeners?
Interaction of, well, obviously it was only the phones that were there. I was taking calls myself when I actually did get the evening slot, which was from 7:30 to 9:30, which was slot, you know, the first section. And then the second section was Radio Romance on Nighttime Music from 9:30 to 11:30. I think there was a switch over from the north at 9:30, which anybody then in Northern Ireland could hear me, whatever way that works. So if I was on, say, 7:30, there's somebody on the border on air broadcasting into Southern Northern Ireland, and then 9:30 they switch back. So I would then go all across both stations. Like, so for the love songs, yeah, it was completely mad. I mean, like, you just had no time. You're just constantly, the phone's ringing nonstop.
So you were heard over a very large area. Just to explain, this was the other station, Boyneside Radio North, which was up at Carrigarnon. And when they went off the air with their own local programming, you were heard over a good part of Northern Ireland as well as around Louth and Meath.
Yeah, sort of the most of the requests I got were from Newry, very few from Belfast, but you did get the odd requests from Belfast, but like Newry was just savage. I mean, the amount of calls from schools, requests and stuff like that. I mean, on years later, I mean, you know, I did bump into one or two people who actually were from Newry and Belfast and actually said to me, I actually play the request. So, you know, at the time, you don't really make a big thing out of it because you're stuck in there trying to entertain people as best you can and playing the songs and stuff. And then it's only years later, it was the same with Radio Romance from the 90s and the noughties, that still, if I'm out and about DJing or whatever, you still hear stories of married couples. Oh, I remember you playing this song for the missus and stuff like that. And now they're married with kids. So at the time, you don't really think about how important the program is. It's only years later, maybe, you know, people say nice things about it and stuff, because you're just not stuck in a rut, but you're just in that mode for so many years. Like, you get in, you're doing it for that long, you don't think of anything else. You're just going and focus on that.
You must have had a pretty big following then over a pretty large area. Where was the furthest you got a request from? Can you remember?
I'm not sure, to be honest with you. I mean, you know, it depended on the signal as well. I think, you know, you could have maybe got one or two from the Isle of Man, which is very rare, but that depended on the weather as well, like, you know. But Dublin was really big at times as well, depending on the weather as well. But yeah, you often got a few from Monaghan, Newry, Dublin, you know. So such a vast area, really, like.
And were you doing any gigs then, or any DJing in nightclubs or anything around the area at the time as well, or was it just the radio show?
I think towards the end of the 80s, I think around 86, 87, I was doing DJ in the Boxing Club in Drogheda, where basically that was that you had all the big top Irish bands in the country at the time, Emotional Fish, Stunning Four of Us, Sisters of Mercy might come in from the UK. I was actually DJing before and after all of those bands as well. So if I was doing a show on a Saturday night, which I was every week, I would literally lock up the station before that, obviously stick the night tape on, and then run down to the club and skip the queue in, and sort of the box records were there all set to go on stage. I'd have to sort of jump across wires and sort of, you know, even some of the band musicians themselves just to get playing. So yeah, it was fairly hectic, like, but, you know, it was enjoyable though.
And did you keep up the day job and do Boyneside right up to the end of 1988, or did you manage to concentrate more on the radio at any stage in the pirate era?
Well, regarding working in Dunn's, was it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I still worked in Dunn's for a few years. I mean, like, yet again, it was hard work. I mean, you know, it was long enough days and doing the radio stuff. But yeah, still DJing down the weekend. So it was all hands on deck. It was all go. But it was a lot of fun, though, you know. I mean, the managers used to come and go in Dunn's. And it was very funny but frustrating at the time, though. I started to panic about 7 o'clock. And I'd say to a certain manager, said, look, you know, I have to leave now because I have to run over. And then they'd say, oh, go down and, you know, sort out the aisle or stack those shelves there. And I'm going, like, it's 7:05, I'm on the air like in about 25 minutes, and you do that for the laugh, you know what I mean? And then, like, I'd have to go up, clock out, and literally run out the door and across West Street into the radio station.
They never listened in, did they?
Oh, they did, yeah. They listened in all right, but they tried to make me as late as possible, and it was sort of a funny thing where, okay, will we let him go maybe at 7:15 tomorrow night and still see if he gets on air in time for 7:30, that type of thing.
And do you have any memories of the raid on Boyneside in 1987, Michael?
The raid, I wasn't there when it happened, but I used to go over, Eddie Caffrey used to be on the air, and I'd normally go over and pick out a bundle of records for when it was on at 7:30. I'd just pick out, you know, spend half an hour picking out sort of a playlist or a few oldies or whatever, and leave them in a pile on top of the shelf in the library. But when I went over one of the days, I don't know what day it was, but there was no equipment there, and Ebon says, you won't be doing your programme tonight. I says, why? He says, you'll be doing it from a caravan up in Tully Esker. I says, Jesus. He says, well, just grab your pile of records there and make sure you get a lift and you're on air at 7:30. So yeah, that was an experience, like broadcasting in the caravan. Like, it was like that Father Ted caravan that you see in the program. It was very small, and if you moved it all in the caravan, the records, the needle would jump on the record, you know what I mean? So yeah, it was interesting that, but like, it was, you know, not many people can say that either, you know. It's one of those things, but it was exciting as well. I never even thought about that you get in trouble over it either, you know. But I think the gear was brought back or given back shortly after. But I think I was in the caravan, I think, for about a week, doing like the Radio Romance and doing the 7:30 to 9:30 slot.
And then they moved back to Donaghy's Mill again, back to the original place. And tell me your memories then, Michael, of the close down in 1988. We have a recording of you just a few days before then, and you were on air right up to the end.
I actually was, yeah. I mean, but yeah, I was doing a top 40, like, and then I was on like literally 7 or 8 days a week up until close down, which I was surprised at, because I thought I only had about a couple of shows. But like, looking at the sets that I have, most of them I've done now and digitized. Jesus, I was on a hell of a lot over that time. And I do remember the final day as well, going into the room, and Eddie was in the on-air studio, and then everybody was around at the round table in the main room. Just seeing all the faces and stuff like that. It was hectic, but it was a good laugh. You know, it was really good. And sad as well at the end of the day, you know.
What kind of an atmosphere was there in the station on the last day?
I think the atmosphere was fairly good. You know, obviously, you know, the station was closing down, but I think we were all hopeful that we'd be getting gigs, you know, a year down the line, whoever got the license, like so. Because we were there for so many years. I think I was only there for the last 4 or 5 years. And like a lot of the lads were there from the early 80s, like, so I was probably the last guy in, so to speak.
And did you ever worry about getting into trouble with the law? I mean, obviously the raid happened. It was quite unusual for there to be raids so late in the pirate era. Most of them were in the earlier 80s period. Were you ever worried about being on the wrong side of the law? Did that cross your mind at all? Was it an issue?
Well, the option was from Ebon, I think he said it to myself and a couple of the lads, and I think Eddie as well. It was up to ourselves if we wanted to continue to broadcast after the 31st of December. And, you know, we're weighing up the options, like, will we or won't we? Like, you know, everyone else is closing down. So we just decided no. We just finished it there, because there's no point in sort of dragging it on, really. And that was just it. We never really talked. But it was in the back of your mind, you know, the cops could probably come in and arrest you. But it was more so just the buzz of sort of doing radio shows at the time, like.
So tell me about this other idea that you had then that would be a precursor of Atlantic 252.
Yeah, I think before the station closed, I came up with an idea. I think it was my idea. I'm not too sure. It could have been somebody else's. I stand corrected. But there was always sort of, you know, a spare room up beside the kitchen up the stairs. And one of us suggested that would we not just set up a 24-hour non-stop pop station. So we thought it was a good idea. And I think I remember vaguely that Eddie was putting in the mixer and the record decks, and jingles were being talked about, and what jingles to go for, where to get them, who do the voiceover. And, you know, we were talking about playlists and stuff like that. And, you know, I was sort of trying to push this, you know, because it would be a breakaway from the main Boyneside on air, because you'd have news, current affairs, death notices and all that type of stuff. Whereas this would be sort of zooming in for the younger audience who probably didn't want to listen to sort of, you know, chat shows or whatever it was. But it never came to fruition. But yeah, the gear was more or less there. It was all set up, ready to go. And I don't know what happened, that somebody just pulled the plug at the last minute, I think. But yeah, it would have been sort of, you know, an Atlantic, you know, a Boyneside 252 of its day or something like that. You know what I mean? So it would have been good and interesting if it went ahead, though.
And looking back on those years now, Michael, what do you think it all meant, or what do you think was important about it? It was a bit of fun, but obviously, you had a following, you had a listenership, you had an audience as well, and you were interacting with people in the area and further afield.
Yeah, I think that the station was very popular, and it was very important to the area as well, especially for people and stuff. You know, it's like even today, like local news is so important. You know, people tune in to hear. Even it was a big thing back in the day, but it's not anymore really, just to hear your name on the radio and stuff was a big thrill, like. And even still, like, I still hear people saying, oh, I have a cassette of you playing my request or top five love songs in Radio Romance, like, you know. So yeah, as I said before, I mean, it's only years later when you get a little bit older, you reflect back and say, Jesus, that actually was a good time. And I think overall the station was a basis of what came after, because I mean, like, a lot of the programs that were on that were more or less, you know, not the same, but the same type of programming when radio became legal.
And your final thoughts then about the state of radio today, Michael, more than 30 years after it was legalized, what kind of an experience does radio offer today, do you think?
I think it still holds a vital part in people's lives, especially over the last few months. News and current affairs is still key to any local radio station and even national radio station. But I see, like, what's happening in the UK, where the likes of Wire are coming in and taking over, you know, 25 or 30 stations and rebranding them all into greatest hits, and like letting, you know, 27 presenters go on a breakfast show, so you only have one guy doing a breakfast. I don't know if it just seems to be very automated, but I can see where they're coming from with the music format, because I mean, like, people in this day and age love nostalgia and they'd like to hear stuff that they grew up listening to, like, song wise and even my case, like the 13 and 14 and a half, I mean, like, you know, I stick on a 60 station or an absolute radio or wherever it is, they know exactly all the songs. So, you know, people, I think, should realize, I mean, you know, going for a particular age group, you know, people do grow up listening to some of the classics. I mean, like, you know, if it's a good song, it doesn't matter whether it's 60 years old or 40 years old or 20 years old. If it's a good song and it's a feel-good song, why don't you play it? You know what I mean? I like the way Heart are doing their playlists in the UK, like the 70s and 80s. Like, if it's a very small playlist, but the songs are, you just turn it on and you know, you're like, your Whitney Houston's, you know, your Jerry Rafferty's. I mean, we all know them and love them, but they do it so well. And as we mentioned, I think, before we started, I mean, Absolute Radio have a great brand as well, you know. So, sort of, I think it's still lots more to sort of do. I'm working on a few radio projects at the moment, a few ideas, and sort of helping a few stations with their social media platforms also. So, yeah, still a lot more to give. Not dead yet.